Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for allowing us to be here this weekend at the Village Church, giving us not only information, but also inspiration as well. Please be with us today and also speak through me. In thy name, amen. Amen. Okay, so I love this topic. This was probably about 15 years ago, I was put in charge of the Alumni Association Conference. So every year at Loma Linda, we had APC, which was around March. And they said, you're going to be the one in charge of putting together the program. So that might not have been a good idea because, this must have been, I want to say maybe 2010, 2011. It was a while ago. And so, being very naive and not understanding the politics of things, I went ahead and I got people that I thought were really interesting. And I got this guy to come, Don McMahon. Have you ever heard of Don McMahon? Okay, so he came from Australia. And he has a book that published, and he had just come out at the time, and he gave a nice presentation. And the title of the book was Acquired or Inspired. And why that's important to understand is because today we're going to talk about medical science confirming Ellen White. So I had a lot of, there's different ways I could approach this topic. I could have approached it and say, let me do as many topics as possible to see where Ellen White has been correct on. But you know what? He's done this so well. So what I decided to do was to pick a few topics and expand on them and maybe learn from them and show how Ellen White has actually been ahead of her time. But if you really want to have a thorough investigation of all of the places where Ellen White has said the what's and the why's, this is really an amazing book to get. You can actually still get it, I think, on Amazon. It's called Acquired or Inspired, Exploring the Origins of the Adventist Lifestyle. So what he did was he went through all of the scientific predictions, if you will, of Ellen G. White and divided it into the what and to the why. And he noticed that her what accuracies were actually very, very high, but her why accuracies were maybe a little bit less. She didn't understand maybe everything about science, and she tried to put it in terms that she could best describe with the education that she had back in the 1800s. Well, as interesting, as time went on, her accuracy started to improve. Isn't that interesting? So back in 1960, there was about a 60% accuracy. And as we got to 2000, her accuracy had gone up from 60% to 87%. It's kind of an artificial.
Based on whose assessment?
Based on general science.
Okay.
Yeah, so in other words, comparing what Ellen White says to the current understanding of science at the time, 60% accurate, and now as science is getting better and better and better, so is Ellen White getting better and better. You understand what I'm saying, right? So some of the things from this, this is not actually from the book, this is what people have said about the book. Ellen White's health statements were far superior, in fact, more than 100 years ahead of any of her peers. So a lot of times she's accused of plagiarism, right? But the question is, how would she know who to copy from? So you have Graham, Cole, Jackson, Kellogg, or Alcott. Modern medical science now recently reveals, now this is the current one, is that she's 97% accurate in her health statements found in the book Spiritual Gifts. She was also currently found to be 87% verifiable in her book Ministry of Healing. The TEND reveals that in due time, these numbers will only continue to rise. Okay.
How do they differentiate between accurate and verifiable?
It had to do with the science, not her statements, to see whether or not something had actually determined whether or not that it had occurred. So sometimes the science hasn't actually gotten in because they're not, The probability of Ellen White copying such a provincial accuracy using random selection is an astonishing chance of 1 out of 20 million. And by the way, he hired an auditor, an independent auditor, to look at this, who was Roman Catholic. And there is actually a part of the book. Dr. Gaim Bradford, Adventist scholar and author of another highly acclaimed book about Ellen White, says of this book, Dr. McMahon, who's an ear, nose, and throat doctor. You know of him? Okay, yeah. Don McMahon has done for the church a wonderful service through his research. If the reader will carefully examine his arguments, they will find he has developed one of the most powerful arguments that can be presented for the inspiration of Ellen White. When people read this book, they will be pondering the question, how could a relatively uneducated woman living in the 19th century be so right at a time when her more educated contemporaries were so wrong? Mm-hmm. And I think it's an outstanding book to read. And it goes through it very... There's actually... in the first iterations of the book, I don't know if they still do this, there was a CD-ROM in the back. That kind of dates the book. There was a CD-ROM in the back with all of the statements collated and all of that sort of stuff. Okay. What I'm going to do today, though, is I'm going to focus on an area that I've been very interested in, and that is specifically with light and the statements that Ellen White has made about light. Now, you have to remember that it was around this time, and I actually read an article, it's a really interesting article, about John Harvey Kellogg and how he understood light at the time, where he got his information from. It was actually from Europe. And he actually went on a number of trips to Europe and went to some high-altitude sanitariums where they were treating tuberculosis and adapted a lot of what he was seeing over there at Battle Creek. And it's really interesting. He was actually pretty straight on. He talked about infrared light, which is what we're going to talk about a little bit, and the effects. And then we're going to delve into a little bit what Ellen White said about light, and we're going to compare it to what the science is now telling us. And some of this stuff is actually pretty new. So we're going to actually have two aspects of today's talk, not only about light and circadian rhythm and mood, but also mitochondria. Okay, so, and that's, I think, the most exciting. So let's get through this pretty quick. The mitochondria, you know, is the powerhouse of the cell. Think of it as an engine in your car. And just like the engine in your car makes heat that could potentially shut down the engine, mitochondria also makes something called reactive oxygen species. And those reactive oxygen species are extremely, extremely reactive. They only have to move a few angstroms and they will damage the structures around them because they have hydroxy radicals. So that oxidative stress has actually been tied to inflammation, cancer, diabetes, and learning disabilities. Even autism has been linked to mitochondrial disease. The body has two systems in place, two cooling systems, if you will, to deal with mitochondrial damage. There's a system at night, and there's a system during the day. The system at night we're very well aware of. There is a gland in the brain called the pineal gland, and when there is no light stimulating the eyes, the pineal gland is free to produce, especially at the beginning of the night, melatonin. Now, melatonin is one of the most powerful antioxidants known to man. It's actually more powerful than glutathione. It actually upregulates the glutathione system itself. It can actually neutralize four different oxidative stress molecules. We're talking about things like superoxide, hydrogen peroxide, and hydroxy radicals. These are things that are made in the mitochondria because of the electron transport chain. In the daytime, there is the sun. We're going to talk a little bit more about the sun. We're going to get to that in a little bit. But this is a list from the Cleveland Clinic of all the things that are associated with mitochondrial diseases. And it basically reads of all the things that are happening in the Western world and in the United States. And that'll become more clear as we talk about why this is happening. So here's the great circadian rhythm that we know about. And you know, the circadian rhythm is probably one of the most interesting discoveries of modern medicine in the last 20 years. We are starting to find out that all of the studies that we have done on medicine, all of the studies that we've done on medical interactions, drug interactions, side effects of medications, they're all mitigated by when you give the medication. And that is because your body at 8 o'clock in the morning is different than your body at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. There is the best time for you to have the best coordination. It's at 2:30 in the afternoon. If I do a pulmonary function test on a patient in the morning and repeat that pulmonary function test in the afternoon, there is statistically significant differences. They might be small, but there are real differences. And that is because your body is on a specific clock. The way I like to think about this is I still have a friend, but he used to work at Disneyland. He used to be part of the crew that would go in at night. And if you think about Disneyland, it's very complex, but when that park closes at 10 or 11 o'clock at night, it's an amazing situation that transforms that place. He used to tell me, there's an army of gardeners that come in, and they go through the entire park, weeding, cutting, trimming. The cash registers are cleared out. The markets are all restocked with the big animals and the Mickey Mouses. The engineers come in, check the rides. All of this stuff is happening from the hours of 12 o'clock at night to 8 o'clock in the morning when the park reopens, so that when the park reopens, it's brand new, it's ready to go. The same thing has to happen in your body. Your body is far more complex, and this is what happens with this clock. For instance, did you know that insulin is the most sensitive at 8 or 9 o'clock in the morning? That means a calorie digested in the morning is far different than a calorie digested in the afternoon. You're going to have less insulin spikes if you're eating food in the morning. So, that, and by the way, that's another statement of Ellen White, right? Eat breakfast like a king, eat lunch like a prince, and dinner like a pauper if you have lunch at all. Key here, melatonin secretion starts at 9 o'clock at night. So in fact, the suprachiasmatic nucleus is like the conductor. This is the thing in the brain that determines what your circadian rhythm is. All of these processes are like instruments in an orchestra. They're all going off at the same time, but they're under the direction of one conductor. And if they're not, you're going to have things that are happening all at the same time, which is not the right thing to have. Imagine if a gardener comes in the middle of the day and starts working on the garden it's a small world. That's not going to be right? We're not going to have, imagine if the engineer shut down Space Mountain in the middle of the day. You can't have that. You have to have that attraction open if Disneyland is going to be able to work. And so that's exactly what happens with this circadian rhythm. So it's important that this happens. Things that are regulated by the circadian rhythm, all of those things there on the left-hand side, plus a lot more. These are things that are essentially vital to the human body. So this is the problem. The problem is that the circadian rhythm, the conductor of the orchestra, which is right here, is attached to your retina. And that light coming in from the outside will go to the suprachiasmatic nucleus and immediately shut down any melatonin coming from the pineal gland. So if your eyes are exposed after 9 o'clock to any kind of light, no melatonin. This is kind of what Tim was talking about just in our last section, is making sure you're going to bed. This melatonin is part of the cooling system for your mitochondria at night. If you don't have it, your car is not going to be cooled. And if you're going up that hill, and if you can barely go up that hill without your engine overheating, you can see what the problem is going to be. You're in a society where we are accustomed to having lights on at night. And this is recent discovery. Ellen White knew nothing about this. Knew nothing about the suprachiasmatic nucleus, knew nothing about melatonin.
Now, what is that suppression last?
It can last for hours, and all it takes is a few lux, one lux. In fact, enough light that can penetrate your eyelid is enough to shut it down. So it's not just enough to close your eyes. You have to make sure that the room environment is dark. And this is a problem with light pollution, living in the cities, having lights on, electricity. It's an issue. Phones, all of that. What's interesting is there's something called the intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, known as IPRGCs. They are especially sensitive to blue light. We know this. Have you ever had your phone and it like shift to night mode and it looks more warm, more red, more orange? It's a gimmick that's saying, okay, we're not going to give you as much of this blue light so we don't shut down your melatonin. In fact, it is more sensitive here, but any kind of light will shut it down. The other thing that's really interesting is that those RPGs are concentrated in the lower portion of your retina, not in the upper portion. And so you remember what happens when you see light? The image gets flipped, correct? So typically, it's light in the upper visual field that is going to be much better at shutting that down. Something that, for instance, if you were outside, where is most of the light coming from when you're outside? Up above. Okay, so I know people that are really into this stuff, and they will make sure that all of the lights in their house at night are down low, not up above. So night lights plugged in, and they'll make sure that they're red, not blue. Okay, they're trying to, and they turn the lights down a lot, so it's almost like you're bumping into things. It may be a little bit extreme, but the best thing to do is simply just close your eyes, go to bed, make sure your room is dark. You'll get the best of that melatonin. So, light after sunset tends to delay your circadian rhythm by suppressing melatonin production in the pineal gland, and this causes your body to delay sleep onset. Light early when you wake up tends to advance or anchor your circadian rhythm, but requires more intensity given that those IPGs are less sensitive in the morning and a lot more sensitive in the evening, and this causes your body to advance in sleep onset. So again, this is what happens. This is why I highly recommend one of the best practices that you can do is when you get up in the morning and the sun is up, go outside. Go outside. The lux from the sun early in the morning, about 100,000 lux. Inside, right here, if I were to measure the lux, it'd be about maybe 50 to 100. And it's all dependent on the amount of lux that you're getting. So if you go outside and it's 100,000 lux, bright sunny day, you can get enough sunshine to anchor your circadian rhythm and get a good night's sleep later that night in about 15 minutes. Very important, yes.
Is there any artificial form of that?
Yes.
Inside?
Absolutely. So if you live in an area like here in Michigan where the sun doesn't come up till late in the wintertime, you can get a 10,000 lux light box on Amazon for about $20. You put it in front of you for about 20 minutes a day, 11 to 15 inches from your eyes. There's no infrared radiation coming from that, but as we'll show, I think we'll show this, it hits the perihabenular nucleus in the brain, which is involved with mood. And this is a great remedy for people who get seasonal affective disorder, people who become depressed in the wintertime because they're not getting sunlight. Putting a light box in the morning has been actually scientifically been shown to alleviate that. So there's a lot of consequences with circadian rhythm disruption. Here we go. Here's the two pathways, the pathway that goes up to the conductor and the pathway that comes down here to the perihabenular nucleus, which is associated with mood. If you're not getting light early in the morning when the sun comes up, you're going to be, some people are susceptible to getting that. Here it is. This is seasonal affective disorder. It affects about 5% of the population, and they get symptoms for about 40% of the year. It affects females more than males. In a meta-analysis that looked at this, they found that, here's the meta-analysis, they found that light exposure early in the morning basically cures this disease. And so getting up in the morning and getting that light stimulates the perihabenular nucleus. If you're living in a place where you can't get it, getting a light box takes care of it. Here's the meta-analysis. Bright light, 3,000 lux hours. So what's 3,000 lux hours? It's 10,000 lux for a third of an hour. That's where we come up with the 20-minute formula, okay? And you can see here multiple studies and meta-analysis, and the overall is that it favors the effect size of light treatment and seasonal affect disorder. What about bipolar depression? Same thing, adjunctive bright light therapy for bipolar depression. That light box in the morning, if you don't have it, if you do have the ability, getting outside into the sunlight is really important. Cortisol. Going outside in the morning when there is bright light is very important for a nice peak in cortisol early in the day. Having cortisol levels peak high at the beginning of the day is very important for the rest of the day, and it basically eliminates a lot of the negative health effects of stress. So people say, oh, cortisol is bad, it's bad. Yeah, it's bad if it's lasting for the whole day, but having a nice peak at the beginning of the day helps with your body for a number of areas, and exposure to bright light accentuates and anchors that circadian rhythm. So it peaks first thing in the morning, gradually tapers off, obviously it goes away at midnight, and it sets the timing for melatonin release about 12 to 14 hours later, which is what you want. So in other words, doing something early in the morning of the day that you get up is going to help you sleep later that night, okay? It's because of the circadian rhythm. And if you don't get up, then that cortisol pulse is going to be shifted later in the day, and that's correlated more with anxiety and depressive disorders. So bright light is a strong stimulus for adrenal production of cortisol, but the retinal photoreceptors are not sensitive in the morning, so you've got to get out there much more. It seems like it's unfair. It's like in the morning time to get the benefits, I've got to be out there for 15 minutes, but when I go to bed at night, all it takes is one photon of light to shut down melatonin. It's actually the case, unfortunately. So you really have to get out there and make sure that you're getting the benefit of 100,000 lux. We'll talk about why being behind a window or being behind a windshield of your car is not good enough. You really need to get outside. By the way, you can couple a lot of these things together because Ellen White also talks about exercise. You can do all these things at the same time, and actually it saves time. Melatonin builds throughout the day, but it is peaked when you go to sleep. Notice what it says here. Even a brief exposure to indoor lighting, like 100 lux, like what would be in here, or electronics causes this pattern of suppression, though to a lesser degree, and light can still be detected on the retina through closed eyelids, sufficiently enough to shut down melatonin production.
And when you say shutting down production, as in?
Done. It's gone. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
For the night.
Why is this important? Remember what we said was a cooling system for mitochondria? During the night, it's melatonin. If you're not getting the cooling system, that means your mitochondria are producing, if we want to get into the technical aspect of this, there's something called the electron transport chain in the mitochondria. This is where basically reduced electrons are being passed down, almost like in a dam situation where it's going down, and as it's going down, protons are being pumped into the inner membrane space. When you get to the very bottom, It has to pass these electrons off to something very oxidized, and that is oxygen. That's the reason why we breathe oxygen. If we didn't breathe oxygen, our electron transport chain wouldn't work. So what it does is it converts oxygen into water. And to do that, it takes four electrons. Four electrons plus oxygen equals water. The first electron that gets put on, it turns it into superoxide. The second electron, it turns it into hydrogen peroxide. The third electron, it turns into a hydroxy radical. And finally, the fourth electron turns it into water. Water is very safe. It doesn't react with anything. But sometimes our body is inefficient, and these oxidative radicals are produced. And if melatonin is not there to mop them up, they damage the mitochondria irreversibly. And now you have damaged mitochondria until your body breaks the whole thing down and builds a new mitochondria. So what happens is when you're going through life and you're not having enough melatonin to protect your mitochondria from being damaged, you start to run into problems. What kind of problems? Robust experimental and mechanistic data showing increased risk of breast cancer initiation, progression, and even resistance to endocrine therapy as a result of melatonin suppression by evening light exposure. In nurses who do night shifts, we see increased risk for cancer. Yes?
Can you supplement?
Good question. I knew it was going to come.
I don't like melatonin.
So here's the problem with melatonin. For nighttime, melatonin supplementation can be done. But you have to be careful because too much melatonin actually has the opposite effect. I would not go more than 5 milligrams. 10 milligrams, 15 milligrams, people actually just become irritated and they don't fall asleep. The other problem with melatonin is make sure when you're buying it in the store that there's a third-party label on there that says this has been tested and yes, we believe there's actually melatonin in here, because there's a lot of problems with people just putting whatever and calling it melatonin. Here's an interesting thing. So people who are blind, in other words, the retina has been severed. So there's no suppression. The pineal gland can make all the melatonin that it wants. It will never be shut off, right? They actually have a lower risk of cancer. Kind of a proof of concept. Significantly reduce cancer. People who are blind not because they've damaged their eyes. They're blind from birth because there's no connection. They actually have lower.
Specific type of cancers that are impacted the most?
I'd have to go back and look. If there's the reference, okay. They will tell you in there which kind of cancers. So how many people like to read at night? And you've got the books, right? You can open the book and have a soft lighting, or you can have those e-books. The e-books give off a lot of light. You may not be able to see this here, but here's the e-book in terms of the spectrum of light that comes off. Here is the soft light when you're reading just a regular book. Do you see the difference between those two? Now, watch what happens when they see how fast they go to sleep. This is how long it takes for the e-book person to go to sleep. This is how long it takes for the soft light to do it. You can see the difference there. 15 minutes versus 25 minutes in terms of sleep latency. And that has to do with melatonin. Melatonin getting suppressed. Again, here's more studies for breast cancer and melatonin regulation. Under highly controlled exposed circumstances, less than one lux of monochromatic light elicited a significant suppression of nocturnal melatonin. That's your cooling system. And again, here I'm just putting up titles of articles out there. Melatonin and cancer risk. Why the incidence of cancer is increasing. The role of light pollution. There's a lot of studies now looking into light, too much light at night, and the cause for cancer. Do you remember the thing there was a while ago about kids and night lights and leukemia? Mm-hmm. This is exactly what they were looking at. So suppressing melatonin at night in kids by leaving night lights on. They're not getting their melatonin.
Even though it was low, it still impacted it.
Potentially, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what should you do in the morning? Sunlight before 9 o'clock, if you can, depending on where you live, 30 seconds to 30 minutes. If you have full sun, probably only a few minutes is all that's necessary. You don't want to wear sunglasses. You don't want to be behind a window or windshield. It'll take a lot longer if you do that. If you don't have access to that, get the 10,000 plus lux lamp. Do it for about 20 to 30 minutes, about 11 to 15 inches from your eyes. And that will help not with the it'll help with your circadian rhythm and the melatonin later that night, but it will also stimulate the perihabenular nucleus and reduce the incidence of SAD, seasonal affective disorder. What about in the evening? Basically, shut down the lights. We know this from a cancer standpoint, from a melatonin standpoint, and also we know it from a metabolic standpoint. Is people who get a good night's sleep, go to bed earlier, they have less diabetes, less hypertension, and also it looks like less cancer as well. Okay? Interesting. We know that now because of science. What did Ellen White say? Quote, "The feeble one should press out into the sunshine as earnestly and naturally as do the shaded plants and vines. The pale and sickly grain blade that has struggled up out of the cold of early spring puts out the natural, healthy, deep green after enjoying for a few days the life, health, and life-giving rays of the sun. Go out into the light and warmth of the glorious sun, you pale and sickly ones, and share with vegetation its life-giving, health-dealing power." Now, we're going to talk a little bit more about this word right here. I believe that every word that Ellen White writes is there for a reason. I'm one of those type of people, yes. I believe the words are actually inspired. Warmth, okay? She didn't know anything about infrared, but we're going to get into that. But here is the statement. Here's the money statement, okay? Ellen White did not know about melatonin. She did not know about the mitochondria. She did not know about the pineal gland or the circadian rhythm. And yet she states this: make it a habit not to sit up after 9 o'clock. Every light should be extinguished. This turning night into day is a wretched, health-destroying habit. How would she say, think about this. She just got done saying about how important light is, and now she's saying how important it is to avoid the light. That takes some sophistication, right? I mean, what's the normal response? Light is important. We should be getting light, 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 light. Here she's saying, shut it off. Exactly at the right time. Right when melatonin. How prevalent is the habit of turning day into night and night into day? Many youth sleep soundly in the morning when they should be up with the early singing birds. What did we just talk about? Sunlight early in the morning, the cortisol, all that, right? Let the youth practice regularity in the hours for going to bed and for rising. Let them purpose in their hearts that they will bring themselves under discipline and practice orderly rules. God is a God of order, and it is the duty of the youth to observe strict rules, for such practices will work for their advantage. Nailed it. This science, we didn't have this science 40 years ago. It's the reason why her percentage was a little bit lower at that time. But we're catching up. Would it not be better for her to break up this habit of turning night into day and the fresh hours of the morning into night? If the youth would form habits of regularity and order, they would improve in health and in spirits, in memory, and in disposition. She nailed all of those. What did we talk about? Depression. We talked about health, memory, all of these things. We have data now that substantiates. It's verifiable. She's absolutely correct. All right. We talked about one, let's talk about two. This is the part that's mind-blowing. So the mitochondria, once again, are the powerhouses of the cell. There they are, okay? They have those little invaginations there so they can have increased surface area for the electron transport chain to occur. And as we said, the mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cell. They are engines, and as engines, they create heat in the form of reactive oxygen species, oxidative stress, things that have to be dealt with. And our body has two ways of getting rid of those things. In the nighttime, we've already talked about melatonin from the pineal gland and the need for no light after 9 o'clock. What about during the day? Obviously, there's plenty of light. As it turns out, there is a special type of light that comes from the sun called near-infrared radiation. This is very important, and I believe it's been overlooked for many years, and it may explain a lot. This is a paper that was published just recently, 2019. This is by Scott Zimmerman, who is a light engineer and has actually created his own company, and Russell Ryder, who is the executive editor of the journal Melatonin, in which this paper is actually published. I've actually talked to both of these gentlemen. They are amazing. So what is their statement? They say here that melatonin, okay, this is the thing that's produced in the pineal gland, is actually proposed to be produced within the actual mitochondria itself in response to sunlight and provides targeted protection of mitochondria from reactive oxygen species. Let's just digest that statement. In other words, the engine is making its own coolant on site. If you think about that, that's exactly what it would need to do. These reactive oxygen species are so dangerous, and they only have to move literally a few angstroms, and they will bind with, alter, and change, and damage any protein or substance that is next to it, because they have these basically just one electron sitting there. And that one electron will interact with anything else and cause damage to it. Okay, that's why hydrogen peroxide is so good at killing. It's why our own immune system uses hydrogen peroxide to kill bacteria. And it's the same reason why that the mitochondria need to be able to produce melatonin on site. And it seems as though, based on the evidence that they're showing here, that near-infrared radiation from the sun penetrates deeply down into the body, affects the mitochondria, and causes production of melatonin on site. They say here, it has now been shown that the mitochondria produce melatonin in many cells in quantities which are orders of magnitude higher than that is produced in the pineal gland. This subcellular melatonin does not fluctuate with our circadian clocks like we've been talking about before. This is there, it's intracellular, it's intramitochondrial, and it's dealing with it there on the spot. Greater than 95% of your body's melatonin is in the mitochondria. They say, based on optical and biological review of the literature, it is proposed that the NIR portion of natural sunlight stimulates an excess of antioxidants in each of our healthy cells, and that the cumulative effect of this antioxidant reservoir is to enhance the body's ability to rapidly and locally deal with changing conditions throughout the day. In this approach, the role of circulatory melatonin from the pineal gland, produced by the pineal gland, is to provide an efficient method of delivering supplemental melatonin during the periods of low cellular activity, nighttime, and solar stimulus to damaged or aging cells in both diurnal and nocturnal animals. While circulatory melatonin may be the hormone of darkness, pineal gland, subcellular melatonin in the mitochondria may be the hormone of daylight. Okay? So two cooling systems. A nighttime cooling system and a daytime cooling system. The daytime cooling system, because the mitochondria is so active because you're doing things, it has to be made on site. At night, the pineal gland can pump in the low level of melatonin to keep things going while the mitochondria is at a low level. So this is where near infrared radiation is, okay? Notice, this is light from the God-given sun. Who created the sun? On which day of the week? Fourth day of the week. Okay, so I'm putting the, you know, science is not something we do on the other days of the week. Everything happens together. Let's put it all together. God created the spectrum. It's God created the sun, and the chemical reactions that are occurring in the sun are just the right type of chemical reactions to give this spread of light and radiation from the sun. 54% of the energy coming from the sun is in this spectrum, and you can't even see it. The majority of the energy coming from the sun is in this spectrum, okay? 39% is visible, and 7% is ultraviolet. We'll talk a little bit more about that. By the way, vitamin D comes from UVB, right there, okay? Unfortunately, when you're on this side of the spectrum, that side of the spectrum is very easily blocked by our atmosphere. And so the only way ultraviolet light is gonna come in is if that sun is pretty much overhead, between the hours of 10 o'clock in the morning and 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And during the wintertime, there's times here here in Michigan, in the wintertime, like right around now, where the sun won't get high enough and you won't be able to get enough ultraviolet. But you know what? No problem here. Mm-hmm. Have you ever pulled up to a stoplight and there's like a guy next to you in a car and he's blasting his music? What do you hear? It's all the low frequency sounds, like boom, boom, right? This is low frequency light. This can penetrate through anything. This comes through, well, other than clouds. It comes through the atmosphere when the sun is very low. No ultraviolet light can come in when the sun is very low. This will penetrate when the sun is low. Not only will it penetrate when the sun is low, it'll penetrate your clothes, your skin, and it will actually penetrate deep into your body. The same reason why you can hear that low frequency light. Again, here's the solar spectrum. Everything to the right of this black line is near infrared radiation. This is the majority of the energy that we're getting from the sun. You can see here that just red light that you can visibly see can penetrate deep into the skin. How do you experience this energy from the sun? Do you know how you experience it? Warmth. What did Ellen White say? Get out into the light and warmth. So I take that as saying, get out into the light, the sun, which gives you near infrared radiation. This is amazing stuff. When they actually look to see, it can penetrate deep down, even up to 8 centimeters into your body. So what does that mean? Have you seen this? When nurses try to put IVs into you, they'll use an infrared light so they can actually see the veins. What's happening here is that near infrared is penetrating through the skin, it's being absorbed by the blood in the veins, and then it gets reflected back and it makes it on an image so you can see exactly where the veins are. Dr. Fosbury, who works for NASA, contacted me after I did a couple of videos, and he sent me this picture of his hand with near-infrared going through his hand. What do you notice about this? Take a good look.
Vessels, blood.
Blood vessels, good. What do you notice? What do you notice missing from this image?
Bone.
Exactly. Near-infrared light penetrates through bone like it's not even there. Exactly, the skull. Do you notice you can't see bones there, right? Yeah, this is really amazing stuff. In fact, what they have done is they've shown that as you start to age, the number of cells in your body starts to go up and then starts to come down. The red is what they estimate are the cells in your body that can see near infrared light. That's a lot. That's the majority of your body can see infrared light. This is mind-blowing, literally mind-blowing. So Scott Zimmerman, the light engineer, has noticed that the same design that we have in our SolSci and Gyro, he's not medical, he's just simply a physicist. This is exactly the same design that they use on jet planes to avoid detection from radar. They basically collect the energy and they distribute it inside so it can't go back. So in other words, near-infrared radiation can penetrate your head, the skull, the cerebral spinal fluid around your brain diffuses the light everywhere, and then these SolSci then corral the energy and project it down into the deepest portion. And what's this stuff here called? Is this white matter or gray matter? It's gray matter, and gray matter is very rich in mitochondria. So in other words, your brain is designed in a way that the mitochondria are put to the surface, that there is a huge amount of folds to increase the surface area. It is then surrounded with cerebral spinal fluid, which is a lens that diffuses the light, and the near infrared can penetrate your skull and give your brain nutrition. Now, you're like, okay, wait a minute, light penetrating through the skull? For those of us in the medical field, how many of you remember doing physical examination to be able to see whether or not the sinuses illuminate to see if they have sinusitis? This is what we used to do. We put a light on there and we would see that the sinus would illuminate. We'd know that the patient did not have pus. Here's another one. We put light on the maxillary sinus. We look into the mouth and we can see in the top of the maxilla, it's lighting up. That's visible light that's penetrating through two aspects of bone, both the bone here on the surface and the bone in the bony palate. Okay, now, if that didn't blow your mind, I'm going to blow your mind even more. Because if there's one thing outside that reflects near-infrared light more than anything else, it's green trees and shrubs and grass. So that if you're outside in the sun and you're surrounded yourself in a green environment, you're not only getting near-infrared radiation from the sun, it's also you're getting twice as much coming back to you. This is what it looks like on a nice sunny day. Notice this area here. This is the part that we want to see near-infrared light on. This is what happens when you're around green leaves. You're getting much, much more near infrared light when you're in a green environment. And the light that's penetrating through your eyes, you think it's just light going through the pupil? No. Near infrared light is penetrating through all of that because it can penetrate very deeply and it's going to the back of your eye. Do you know why it needs to do that? Because the cones and the rods are extremely active and the mitochondria there is very, very active. And so here's the situation that we're dealing with right now in modern man. We are now, for the first time in our lives in thousands of years, being exposed to visible light without near-infrared light. Think about that. Think about that. Do you understand what I'm saying? In other words, the cones and the rods are having to work to process visible light, but the mitochondria, which is the backbone of that organization, is not getting the appropriate near-infrared to sustain it. There's a study that actually was done that showed that elderly people who have low visual acuity, their visual acuity actually improves when they go outside. Interesting stuff, isn't it? So this is a near-infrared photograph of outside. What do the trees look like? They're bright. They're like light bulbs. Do you know, by the way, your phones, actually, the visible spectrum of your phone goes a little bit into the near infrared. So if you have a remote control on your TV, which of course none of you ever use, right? If you press the button, the light is actually giving off a signal. You will not be able to see that with your naked eye. But if you film it with your iPhone, you will see the light coming on. Because this actually goes a little bit into near infrared, a little bit. But this is what it looks like. Central Park. The buildings, the concrete jungle, you don't get any reflection of near infrared. The trees, they do. So what have we seen? Here is a paper. We have known for decades that people who live in green spaces do better. But I think now we're just trying to figure out why that is the case. And it may be because of near infrared light. Look what they said. We found that spending time in or living close to natural green spaces is associated with diverse and significant health benefits. It reduces the risk of type 2 diabetes, cardiovascular disease, premature death, preterm birth, and increases sleep duration. Quote, people living closer to nature also had reduced diastolic blood pressure, heart rate, and stress. In fact, one of the really interesting things we found is that exposure to green space significantly reduces people's levels of salivary cortisol, a physiological marker of stress. It's amazing stuff. Remember what Ellen White said about when they were building the sanitarium? They said, don't cut the trees down. We want a lot of green space. It's amazing stuff. This was a PhD thesis. Look at all the things that happen with the benefit of daylighting on students. All of these things were benefits. All of these things here got reduced. All the bad things went down. All the good things went up. Amazing stuff. You know that there's actually federal guidelines for school building. When you are building a school for students, there has to be enough natural light in the room because we have known for decades that students that learn in a natural light environment do better. We're finding out why. This is a great study. Let me show you here. So how fast can this actually work? This is a study that was done in Oxford and Leiden, Netherlands. Very simple study. They asked them to go in and have their blood drawn. And they looked at diabetes, things called MODY. They also looked at cholesterol, triglycerides. And then they looked at the weather report in the days, 7 days prior to the blood draw. And they could correlate better scores with more sun in the 7 days previous. So in other words, this effect can work that quickly in 7 days. And those are the scores there. The HOMA scores, HOMA IR, HOMA B, insulin, glucose, it's all there. Bright sunlight, but not outdoor temperature. Okay, so here's another study that was done. This is actually by Fosbury again. He sent me this. This is actually about to be published. This is someone doing a glucose tolerance test. One is with red light. The other one is without red light. Notice what happens. This is measured in millimoles per liter. It's not what we measure in here in the United States. This is done in England. But notice that there is a higher spike in glucose when they are not exposed to light. And here, there is a shorter amount of spike in glucose when they are exposed to light. Basically, folks, is you should eat when the sun is out. That's the bottom line. We can see very clearly that our bodies are designed to deal with glucose and eating when the sun is out. So as much as possible, go outside when you eat. And maybe when you come home late at night and the sun is down, maybe that's not a good time to eat. All right, what about ionizing radiation? Look here, UVA, UVB, UVA is the bad stuff. This is the stuff that causes cancer. This is stuff you want to try to avoid potentially. But even then, they found that when people had melanoma, the ones that did better were the ones that had more sun exposure, interestingly. Okay, because they're mitochondria. Look at this. What were the things that were associated with decreased death in people with melanoma? High intermittent sun exposure, solar elastosis. Let's take that picture. All right. You good? Okay. This is the famous Southern Sweden cohort. So they took 30,000 Swedish women and they followed them for 20 years. And they looked at over 2,500 deaths over that 20 years. This is what they found, that the women who had sun avoiding exposure had lower survivals, and those that had sun active exposures had greater survival. What about the brain? Okay, the people, both in multiple sclerosis and in the controls, the people that had the highest amount of sun exposure had the highest gray matter volume and total brain volume.
Over what time frame?
This was
summer.
It was a cross-sectional surface area. I don't remember over what period of time it was, but that's the reference.
Okay.
Yeah, both for multiple sclerosis and for controls. It seemed to actually be even more for multiple sclerosis. This is near infrared light and aging. So this is where they actually penetrate the brain with high powered near infrared light, and it showed an improvement in overall performance, mathematical processing, delayed memory, and right hand motor function. Okay, COVID, ready to blow your mind on COVID here. So you need to know that in your body, in all of your cells, there's something called angiotensin II, which is a prooxidant. And that gets converted into angiotensin 1-7, which is an antioxidant. We call this a four-point switch in basketball. You steal the ball at one end and you score at the other end, okay? If you can drop the amount of prooxidants and convert it into antioxidants, if you convert your enemies into friends, that's great, right? Unfortunately, the enzyme that does that is ACE2, okay? And so what happens is, again, prooxidants is going to lead to increased reactive oxygen species, that the green arrow is bad. But angiotensin 1-7 is going to block reactive oxygen species. The problem is that when you get the virus, it blocks ACE2. And so what happens is you get more prooxidants, you get less antioxidants, and then, of course, the white blood cells themselves have prooxidants in them. And so you get this huge rush of reactive oxygen species. So imagine this. Here's your car with the mitochondrial engine, and you're having a problem going up the hill. Your car is overheating and you barely get it over the hill, okay? Now imagine what happens when COVID comes along. It's no longer a little hill, it's now a mountain that you're climbing, and there's no way that engine is gonna get you up to the top without completely burning out, and that's what happened. So in other words, it's a stress test. How good are your cells? Are your cells able to withstand the antioxidants or the oxidative stress of COVID? Because what happens is that these cells that line your blood vessels become so damaged that they release platelets, they release von Willebrand's factor, and you get these microclots, which causes the hypoxemia in these patients. And so what is the treatment solution for this is to mitigate reactive oxygen species. That means that making sure you have melatonin at night from your pineal gland and making sure that you have melatonin from the sun during the day. Do you remember what we did in 1918? Mm-hmm. We used to get people where?
Outside
in the sun. We didn't know how, but we did. So let me nail down a couple of scientific points about this. If this is the case, we should see increased levels of oxidative stress in these patients. And in fact, we do. So at all levels of age, COVID versus control, we're looking at intracellular glutathione, which is a measure of antioxidants. So we want a lot. But notice that in COVID, at all ages, we have lower levels of antioxidant. In fact, as you get older, just normal, you're going to be more susceptible because you don't have as much antioxidants. All right? What about T-bars, which is a measure of oxidative stress? At all levels, in COVID, we had higher and higher levels of oxidative stress in these patients, both as you got older and also as you went from negative to COVID. Okay, what about damage? So F2 isoprostane is a measure of damage. Same situation. As you get older, you're having more and more damage that's accumulating as you get older, but also with COVID, it went up higher. So clearly, COVID is increasing oxidative damage. So it's really important that you have a lot of antioxidant systems in your body. We know from studies looking at vitamin D deficiency, people who had survival had better levels of vitamin D. Here we're looking at 12 nanograms versus less than 12 nanograms. Here we're looking at greater than 20 versus less than 20. And clearly there was a difference. Vitamin D may have a benefit itself in taking vitamin D. I take supplements with vitamin D as well. But it may also be a marker of being out in the sun. People who are out in the sun more have higher vitamin D levels. And if they're out in the sun more, they're definitely be getting near infrared radiation, which may be causing more melatonin production and doing that. So the question is, do we have evidence that something other than vitamin D is working in COVID? Amazing study. Here they looked at that very same thing. They looked at the United States in the wintertime of that first year of the pandemic, and they eliminated anywhere in the United States in the wintertime that could have gotten some vitamin D. So they just completely eliminated the southern portion of the United States. They also looked at England, which of course is pretty high up north, and amazingly, they also looked at Italy. And what they found was that as latitude went up, as latitude went up this way, the mortality rates were the highest at the top. You can see here that as the amount of UVA increased, So not from UVB, but UVA, that the mortality went down. Okay, and then they also showed that happening in England and also in Italy.
UVB, or is it itself?
Exactly. So that's the question: is that they looked at UVA, but of course we know that even at these levels up here, where you're not getting UVB, you're still getting NIR, because NIR can come in at any level. In fact, in the wintertime, the snow melts. Do you know why the snow melts? Because it absorbs near infrared radiation. That's the reason why. That's the only reason why snow melts in the wintertime when the sun comes up. So this is what they actually said in this journal. They said, in conclusion, this study is observational, and therefore any causal interpretation needs to be taken with caution. But notice what they said. However, if the relationship identified proves to be causal, it suggests that optimizing sun exposure may be a possible public health intervention, given that the effect appears independent of a vitamin D pathway. It suggests possible new COVID-19 therapies. Let me tell you, it's not new. We've been doing this for a long time. This goes back to England. This is England here. This is the senior girls' surgical cases. These are young ladies that were there for surgery and orthopedics. They're all outside in the surgical lawn. Notice how these decks here are actually built in a way so that the beds can be moved out, moved to the side, and it doesn't block the door. They actually designed sun treatments into the actual facility that they were managing. Sun exposure, heliotherapy, very important. I knew a neurosurgeon that worked up in Washington, and she worked at the old county hospital in Seattle. And she said that if you go there, even to this day, there's a solarium that is there, a big solarium. And they used to move the patients in the wintertime under the glass so they could get sun. And in the summertime, they could actually remove the glass and be outside into the fresh air. You can always do it, but all right. So notice what Ellen White says. She doesn't know what a mitochondria is. She doesn't know what any of this stuff is. But again, what does she say? Go out into the light and what?
Warm.
To me, that's like, oh, wow. Do you see how that one word, that tells me that she was trying to say near infrared light. Maybe she knew what that was. I'm sure that there were scientists at that time. Maybe it was. She was shown probably by Envision that this was an important aspect of the sun and that it was felt physically by warmth. If you do this today, go outside when the sun is out, close your eyes. Even through your clothes, you can feel where that sun is. And it's because it's penetrating through all of that. It's amazing. Do you guys remember the incident that happened back in the 1990s when Sony came out with a night cam? It used near-infrared light to be able to see at night. And with a few adjustments of that camcorder, they discovered something not too savory, that they could actually see through clothes. And so Sony had to drop that camera. It's because that near-infrared light will penetrate through and then come back. And this is actually the benefit of that. So this is what... Now, this is where it gets mind-blowing, right? This is what near-infrared looks like on a summer day in Kansas. This is what we used to experience 100 years ago. This is what it looks like today. And the reason is that we get no infrared light from these lights. And the windows that we put on our homes are actually designed to filter out near-infrared light so that it's cheaper to cool the house down. You don't actually get it that way. So this is what the authors of that study showed. This is how much near-infrared radiation we got in 1800. This is how much we're getting today because of that. We spend 93% of our hours in America, 93% of our waking hours inside of a building. And we have LED lights, and we have windows that do not transmit near-infrared light. So if you...
What percentage does it not transmit?
I'll show you that. I actually have a slide. There's different types of glass. So let's talk about the lights first. Incandescent is this nice blue one here. Do you see how in the infrared light, how there's still, actually most of the energy from Edison's invention still gives you quite a bit of near infrared radiation. But if you look at the 3000K LED, all of the energy by design is in the visible spectrum.
And they're not good for you, right? Because migraine.
They flicker. So if some people get, there is a flicker. And so Scott Zimmerman, I don't have any financial incentive, or I'm not connected with Scott Zimmerman anyway, but he is actually developing a light bulb company made out of LEDs that actually specifically give off in near infrared. His thing is called not just full spectrum lighting, but full biological spectrum lighting. And there's a number of them that are coming out with that. Here's the slide that answers your question. So there are, this is clear glass that you would have in a home 50, 60 years ago. And there's different types of glass. There's high solar, low E, there's moderate solar, low E, and then there is low solar, low E. And now those are different amounts of near infrared light that passes. One way of really figuring out really easily whether or not this is the case, when the sun is coming through, put your back to it and feel. Can you feel warmth coming through? The chances are that you're getting near infrared radiation. There was a really interesting experiment. This was done back in the 1700s, 1800s when they first discovered this. They wanted to figure out what the temperature of light was. So they put up this big prism, the scientist in the 1700s put up this big prism of light, and light was coming in on the table. There was red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, and then, you know, nothing on either side. So what he did was he put a thermometer in each one of those lights that was shining, and then he put a control thermometer just on the outside of red as the control light. And then he was mind blown because all of the other lights were the same temperature and something here was like going off the charts. And he realized, he says, there must be, this is an amazing, these guys were brilliant. He says, there must be something here that is unfit, some sort of light that is unfit to be seen. That was the description that he had. He discovered near infrared light, which is basically hot. It transmits heat. We feel it as heat. It's amazing stuff.
So, yes. To your left, what was that?
It's, you know, Roy B. Jiv, right? Was it red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet? And he put what was thought was the control into the actual near infrared spectrum that he couldn't see. Indigo. Yeah, indigo. There he goes. Roy G. Biv. Thank you. Indigo violet. So this is what we used to see 100 years ago. Think about this. This is mind blowing. Okay, you're sitting at a campfire. But you're like, but you're getting light. You're getting light, and that's not good. But think about it. Is it blue light or is it red light? It's red light. And is it up high or is it down low? It's down low. You see that? And what comes off of the fire? Near infrared light. So this is the reason why you feel so good in a campfire, like Tim was saying. It's great for sleep because you're getting near infrared light. It's not shutting down melatonin too much. And you go to bed.
October 31, the most popular place to stop was the people who had a burn barrel out.
Yeah.
For Halloween.
There's something about it.
Kids, there's 2 inches of snow on the ground, but they stand there in the burn barrel shadow.
There's something about it. There's just something that we get drawn to, a nice fire at night. It's just like a campfire. You have community. You talk. You're seeing people. It's so much more healthy as compared to this. This is what we have today. So something even better about what God has designed. So what about those people that spend time outside all the time? So think about what happens. So here we have the UV. Here we have UV, okay? And notice that UV peaks as the sun is highest at noon. And this is what happens to NIR, okay? It comes through at any angle. So you're just going to see a nice linear curve. Here you're going to see an exponential curve. Now think about what happens. For somebody who stays outside for the whole day, at the beginning of the day, what are they getting? A bunch of NIR. It's building up their antioxidants. They're getting filled up with melatonin, ready to take on the onslaught of the day at noon, okay? But they're already built up. And then what happens? Any damage that happens afterwards, it comes back down. Now you have NIR for the rest of the day to basically repair any damage that's there. It's all built into a system. It's perfect. So what do we do? So be careful. If you decide to skip going outside and you just go outside at noon, you probably want to avoid direct sunlight exposure. So you can go outside and get the benefit of this. The sun is low in the sky. You know, if the sun is high overhead in the summertime and you don't want to get directly exposed, cover up. Put a hat on, cover up, stay in the shade. If you're in green areas, that light will reflect off and come to you. You'll get the benefit of that. You don't have to be in direct sunlight. You don't have to worry about getting cancer or skin cancer. So overall, what should we do? Get as much natural sunlight as possible, avoiding glass in between after waking, exposure to low-level light, avoid any type of light exposure after sunset, especially blue light. Okay, let's go through some quotes from Ellen White. Now you are educated on the science. Let's just quickly go through what she said about light, and you'll see this is amazing. Who can be but joyous in the glad sunshine, beholding the beauties of nature and seeing the evidence of the goodness of love of God in the lofty trees and the earth covered with its green carpet, and adorned with beautiful flowers of every hue. Our wise Creator loves to see His children healthful and happy. Should we not remember God as we look upon these evidences of His love? Would we not be very ungrateful if we did not acknowledge Him in His creative works? It was the design of heaven that we should look through nature upon to nature's God, and should adore our Heavenly Father for the tokens He has given us that He wants us to be healthful and happy. Those who are old enough should every day, that the weather will admit, have a portion of their work in the open air and sunshine. Children and women should not fail to spend some hours each day in exercise out of doors. Why does she say children and women? Because traditionally, at the time that she's writing, they spent a lot of their time indoors. It was the men who went outside. They were getting plenty of sunlight. The women and the children were not, and they needed to do that. This has proved a great blessing to me, when in every feeble health I have occupied some time in my flower garden and among the small fruits doing light work, which has never failed to prove a success in recovering my health and overcoming depression of spirits. She even mentions the depression of spirits. She's getting light to the perihabenular nucleus. Yes.
At the Adventist Village, we talk about Goodlow Harper Bell, who wanted to move to Bering Springs so they could have agriculture.
There you go. And she actually talks about people, they're talking about how they're going to construct the sanitarium. They're like, oh, we're going to cut this down. They're like, no, don't cut the trees down. You need those trees. And she actually talks about some of the chemicals that come off of the trees that are actually beneficial. That's a whole other lecture. We can talk about phytosides and those sorts of things.
That's not raking leaves, though, is it?
No. Well, but if you're next to the tree raking the leaves, I guess the trees are next to the tree, right?
Did you know that our infamous Bill Gates wants to cut down the trees and bury them?
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they're also making college campuses, and if I'm not mistaken, there was kind of a controversial submission architecturally for a building that would house students that was the most economical in terms of space, and what they would do is they would have screens, LED screens, with scenes of the outside on the screen. Yeah, very controversial, for good reason. There are but a few who realize that in order to enjoy health and cheerfulness, they must have an abundance of sunlight, pure air, and physical exercise. We pity little children who are kept confined indoors when the sun is shining gloriously without. If parents would dress their children for healthfulness instead of according to fashion, they would thoroughly clothe their limbs of their girls. So here's the thing about it. She talks about sunlight. The boys would have, you know, their shoulders covered. The girls would not. And she's saying, let them go outside, cover them. Doesn't matter, because the sun, the type of sunlight that we're talking about, is going to penetrate through those clothes, and it's going to keep them warm when they go outside on those days. So she says, the limbs of the girls as they do those of their boys, and let them outdoors in the spring, summer, and fall to sport and play as free as the lambs. This is what they do. Instead, what are we doing today? They're on, and I have kids too. It's a struggle. Turn it off, go outside. This is what I tell them. Turn it off, go outside. Go play basketball, go get outside into the sunlight, because it's really important. Do not close the blinds you have your windows draped with. Remember now, this is back when they had regular glass, okay? Drape with one or two curtains to shut out the beautiful sun that bears health and cheerfulness in its bright beams. Parents, do not close the pleasant rooms in your houses from your children and open them merely to visitors. I have been in many houses where the best rooms were kept closed by blinds and curtains, so that not a ray of sunshine could brighten, gladden, and purify the rooms of the commencement to the close of a week to the close. This choice, closed rooms deprived of the health-giving rays of the sun, seemed like a damp cellar. A chill seemed to penetrate me as I tarried even a short time in these beautiful rooms, too precious from even the rays of the sun to be admitted. There is a benefit to having sun. No room in the house should be considered furnished and adorned without the cheering, enlivening light and sunshine, which are heaven's own free gift to man. If rooms are closed even one day, excluding these precious blessings, be they bedrooms or parlors, no one should be invited to occupy them until they have been thoroughly ventilated and the rays of the sun freely admitted. This is the only way rooms can be kept free from impurities. That's pretty...
Mycotoxins,
yeah. So fungi, yeah. This is the only way rooms can be kept free from impurities. The air in unoccupied rooms may be cold, but this is evidence that it is pure. How many times do we are so set on energy conservation. Everything is ruled by energy conservation. Everything. Do you guys know who Joseph Allen is? Joseph Allen is a professor in the Chan Harvard School of Public Health. And he is he's the one that invented the term sick buildings. He's the one that invented the term forever chemicals. And he has been he's been recently featured on programs like 60 Minutes talking about how we need to ventilate, how we've been closing things up and we need to open the window. He actually shows you on a carbon dioxide meter. You can pick up a carbon dioxide meter for about $100 or so, but it actually is very interesting. So it basically uses carbon dioxide as a surrogate for ventilation. And if you take it with you and it goes over 1,000, that can tell you that that room is not very well ventilated. We did this at our house in the bedroom that I sleep in. We put it in there, it never got above 800. I put it into my son's bedroom and it was well over 1,000, 1,300. And so we made changes in that room. We kept doors open. He's on the first floor, so we're not thrilled about leaving the window open. But if we open doors in the house, he can get enough ventilation. So this can actually help with brain function and improve it. So my son needs all the brain improvement he can get. It would seem like the ladies have a particular dislike for the sunlight, for they remain most of the time shut in from its influence. How many of you know that, right? Oh, my skin, it's going to be, you know, I'm saying this only because I see this with my wife sometimes. She's like, no, I don't want to go outside. I finally convinced her to get outside, but they're very concerned about sun damage to their skin. For they remain most in the time shut in from its influence, with curtains closed to keep it from the fading carpets, while they, for the want of it, they themselves fade and become weak and sickly, like the plants which grow in the shade, and are never kissed and colored and strengthened by the life-giving rays of the sun. If they perchance they venture out into the open air and sunlight, they dare not go out without carrying a shade to keep the sun from their tanning their lily-white cheeks, just as though pale and sickly-looking countenances were more beautiful and desirable than those which are ever blooming with the fresh, clear, sparkling hues of health. Do you like that? Isn't that interesting? And yet today, we've grown up with this thing about cover up, make sure you're not into the sun. I mean, we don't have to go to the extreme and be like the people on the beach, right? But getting enough sunlight, I think, is extremely important. She says, ladies, if you wish to be strong and healthy and desire to possess true beauty and not the sentimental shadow of it, seek the glorious God-given sunlight and bask in the smiles of the light of life of the world. Let it enter freely into your dwellings and let it occupy no room where it cannot and does not enter. And occupy no room where it cannot and does not enter. And be outdoors all that you can every day, and especially when the sun shines. And fear not to look old King Saul in the face, instead of cowardly sulking under a parasol as though ashamed to meet its keen and searching glance. Isn't that just amazing language? It's almost like a poet, right? Sunlight is one of the best tonics and beautifiers in the world, and therefore men, women, and children, one and all, should seek it as one of the great natural agencies which help to form the elixir of life. These are very good and wholesome words. She says that at the end of that statement in review. And that is it. So I think what I've tried to show here is that Ellen White, yes, if you want a full breadth of all of the scientific knowledge, I highly recommend getting that book at the beginning. If you really want a comprehensive comparison of all of her statements and want to verify that, I think there's actually a lot of validity in doing that. What I tried to show here is taking just a slice of that and showing how in one area the science has progressed over the last 150 years and Ellen White has been absolutely correct from day one. It's just amazing. Mm-hmm. Questions? Amen. Amen. Yes?
One of those paragraphs that said the skin strengthened by the sun.
Yes. Let's see, which one was that?
Maybe two or three back.
It might have been. I may have gone too far. Let's go back. Is this the one? The last one?
Kissed
and
colored
and strengthened. There we go. The lily white cheeks, perhaps? I think I remember somewhere in there. Anyway, yes.
It's about it's where the paragraph ended.
Do you want me to go back?
And the word and, no.
Oh, it's
the next line, strengthened.
Yes. like the plants grow in the shade and never kiss in color and strengthened by the life-giving rays of the sun, if perchance, I think she's talking about the plants being strengthened. Oh, wait, maybe not.
What do you guess strengthened is referring to?
The plants which grow in the shade and are never kissed and colored and strengthened by the, yeah, I think she's talking about the plants. Yeah.
She does say, well, for the want of it, they themselves fade and become weak and sickly like the plants.
Right, right. I think she's referring to the plants, but I think we can take the parallel because she's saying it's like the plants. So the skin should be strengthened. Yeah, and we know that. That's the case. Have you seen these beauty products where they actually, I know this because my wife uses this, but it's like a mask that you put on and there's an infrared laser that actually penetrates through the skin. And what's supposed to happen there is the energy is supposed to be excited in the cells and it's supposed to make collagen and it's supposed to strengthen the skin and make it more tight. And it works. It works, yeah. But you can get the same thing going outside.
Tell us all your wife's secrets.
I know. I should.
You'll be in trouble.
I would. Yes. Yes.
So you mentioned the 9 p.m. the 9 o'clock thing. But yeah. We live on a globe. Is there a better way of kind of gauging that or measuring that, or why? I mean, because that doesn't obviously apply.
Yeah. The best way of measuring it, if you could, is to know when your temperature nadir is, and then actually marching through your circadian rhythm to figure out when you give off melatonin. Another way of doing it is actually there's a way of measuring salivary melatonin. So if you have access to that, if you have that ability to measure salivary, it's called dim light melatonin onset, where you measure that, that's the time that you want to shut down the lights, because that's when melatonin is starting to be secreted, which is on that clock, mm-hmm. and that's when you want to make sure that you're not preventing that that from going up. In most people, it's around 9 o'clock. But if your circadian rhythm is shifted and delayed, I should say, then it might be a little bit later. Yeah. For me, being here right now on the East Coast, yeah, my dim light melatonin onset is probably around midnight. But when I go back home, it'll be around 9 o'clock, hopefully. Yeah.
There's a yeah. slide that talks about Alzheimer's.
Yes. That was way back in our first talk, I think. Or maybe not.
It was down at the bottom.
Yes, I remember that too. And we just sort of passed over that. Let's see if I can. It was like right down here in this corner.
Let's.
Yes, it was. And it was probably talking about light. It was back in the neurologist stuff.
Sorry.
That's okay. That hand picture was just amazing. I knew I had to include that when he sent that to me.
There it was. Go back.
Oh.
Two more. There you go.
Oh, okay. May have a role in the prevention or treatment of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. Again, it has to do with that at the very first slide of the dementia and the effect of damaged mitochondria. So just as a quick aside, if you have damaged mitochondria, so let's just say you're like, oh man, I have not been following the laws of health, and I probably have damaged mitochondria, and I would like to get better mitochondria. So one of the ways that you have of getting better mitochondria is to allow your body to destroy the old mitochondria and let it build back better. And one of the ways of doing that, yeah, you like that build back better part? Yeah, I know it's unfortunate. Build back in a better way, let's put it that way. Intermittent fasting. So that allows your body to break down the mitochondria. So I had a patient that came to me. He had long COVID. My job is to figure out why these people have this and to make sure it's not something I have to treat. So we did everything. We checked for blood clots. We did an echocardiogram. Everything was normal. Okay. So I told him, I went through this and I told him about the mitochondria and I told him about all this. And I said, okay, this is what I want you to do. I want you to get outside more. Get outside in the sun. Okay. And he was very excited about doing this because I explained it all. And the other thing I want you to do is I want to make sure that you do not eat anything after 5:30, okay? So have a nice breakfast, have a good lunch, and then after 5:30, nothing. And he had these symptoms, 8 out of 10 shortness of breath for a year, for more than a year. And he came and saw me, and I told him to do this. And he came back to me 4 weeks later, ecstatic. Because his shortness of breath level went from 8 out of 10 to 3 out of 10. He said, I don't even feel it anymore. His gastroesophageal reflux disease completely went away. Yeah, his gastroesophageal reflux disease completely went away because he was eating late at night, and it was causing him to have GERD, and then he couldn't sleep. Mm-hmm. And so what was happening, now his body was able to break down all of those things at night because now his circadian rhythm was in sync with ketogenesis. See, when you stop eating, you start to burn fatty acids and you make ketones. And people are like, oh, that's a great way of losing weight and stuff. No, it's even more than that. Because the ketones actually signal your body to make genes that are designed to break, to survey, find bad things and break them down. These are designer genes. Yeah, exactly. They are designed specifically to break things down. And so the way I believe this is probably, if we were just get back to the regular health message, there wouldn't be COVID, there wouldn't be long COVID. And one of the ways that we can do this is by allowing the body to break damage things down at night and then bring it back. So now you have a mitochondria that's functioning, you have more energy, and you have melatonin to keep it and sustain it that way. So this is the treatment that I'm doing now for my long COVID patients. I'm telling them to get outside in the sun, and I'm telling them to not eat anything after 5:30. And this guy religiously followed it.
That's it?
That's all I told him to do. That was it.
Do you mean to tell me that when Ellen White, God instructed her that two meals are better than three?
They are.
Fantastic.
You know, this is actually really amazing because when I remember my parents and my grandparents telling me that when I was growing up, I remember thinking, well, good luck trying to convince the world that only two meals a day, right? And so we as Adventists sat on that for how many years? And now what's the biggest fat? What's the biggest fat in diet? Intermittent fasting.
Unfortunately, yeah. Most people skip breakfast, go lunch, and dinner.
Exactly. And you know what? When I was starting to learn about intermittent fasting, that's exactly what I did because I wanted to be, to me, dinner was a social construct, right? Mm-hmm. It's a reasonable thing. But then I learned circadian rhythm, insulin, it's already built into the system. Insulin is more sensitive in the morning. It makes no sense to skip breakfast and eat dinner when we know that insulin is primed and ready to work in the morning. It makes much more sense to eat breakfast and lunch and skip dinner than to skip breakfast and eat lunch. By the way, when you're fasting at night, the next meal that you have breaks your fast. You got it. Breaks your fast. That's why they call it breakfast. Yeah.
When you mentioned about comparing COVID mortality.
Yeah.
At higher latitudes, normally.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Then what about Canada? Canada had less mortality than the U.S. and they're even higher.
Well, so Canada is a different system than the United States. What they did was they looked within the system and they found, I actually worked with a geologist out of University of Mexico. Her name was Dr. Scutch. And what we did was we looked at all of the world's mortalities in COVID-19 and we found something very interesting. We found that first and foremost, mortality in the country was tied to the BMI. The bigger the BMI, the more the mortality, right?
That's stronger than vitamin D.
Exactly. But then here was the other thing that we found that was really interesting. When we separated out the low BMI countries from the high BMI countries, then we found that latitude mattered in the high BMI countries, but not in the low BMI countries. So then this theory comes up, like, if you are so big that the near infrared radiation can't penetrate as much, do you see how that might actually be? So that, in other words, it gets to an area or it gets to a situation where that you're so big that it now matters how much sunlight you're actually getting. And so, and that's why a latitude. So what we found was in countries that had more than 50% of the country had obesity or being overweight, that there was a correlation with latitude. But if it was less, then that correlation went away. So for instance, in Africa, didn't see as much. It was a very rough study. It was more hypothesis generating than saying, like for instance, there's some countries like Chile, right? What's the latitude of Chile? Everything, right? Yeah, so it's really hard to, like, some of those countries are not aligned in a way that you can really do good research. It was very rough and more hypothesis generating, but this what we're seeing here with melatonin and infrared seems to feed into that. Obviously, more research needs to be done to see whether or not.
Higher BMI, you're more inflamed chronically.
Correct. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we saw the. Remember these.
I think you answered it when you said show the slide that said that it can go 8 centimeters deep.
There it is.
You've got eight centimeters. You've got 20 centimeters of adipose tissue. You're not going to get through it.
Exactly. So this one right here. So this was the reason why there's two of them is that this was darker skin people, and this is lighter skin people, and you can see a little bit more penetration in the lighter skin people, but you can see in both cases it goes to about eight centimeters. Yeah, and then this is just the amazing. I mean, that just says it right there. Yeah.
That paper where you compared, someone compared the two. The metabolic.
Oh, yeah. England and yes. The Netherlands. Yeah.
Were they compared the two countries or?
No. They were just, they had a relationship, a research relationship, and so they did the experiment in both of those.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
7 days in both, yeah. It was in Leiden in Oxfordshire. But, I mean, it's just, there's no bones. You can't see any bones. It just goes right through. And so the whole point of that study was like the human body is designed to be optical. There's an optics to the human body and how we are designed that we don't even realize.
My previous comment was the melatonin rich and melatonin light, that somehow relates to the skin.
Are you talking about melanin or melatonin?
Melanin.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Uh-huh.
Color.
Correct. Well, we know that people who have darker colored skin also absorb less vitamin D. And so, yeah, there's because it's reflecting and are absorbing it. It's got to get through a deeper amount. In terms of one other thing I'd mention to you is that the sanctuary in the human body. So this is an area that I like to talk about as well. Are you all familiar with the compartments of the body in terms of the intravascular space, the extravascular space, and the intracellular space, and all that? So if you look at that, that's actually the sanctuary. It's actually the sanctuary. The intravascular space is where the blood is, right? And that's the altar of sacrifice. And just like when the high priest would go from the altar of sacrifice to go into the holy place, he had to bathe in the laver, right? Mm-hmm. He had to dip in the laver before he went in, and he had to dip in the laver after he came out. Well, after the nutrients in the blood pass in the blood and diffuse, where do they go? They go from the intravascular space into the extracellular space. That's the fluid. That's the lymph. That's the water. That's the laver. And that's where all the nutrients go. And then what happens? The high priest then goes into a chamber with two compartments, a chamber within a chamber, in other words, correct? And that's exactly what happens in the cell. The nutrients go into a cell, which is a chamber within a chamber, the nucleus and the cytoplasm. And the three objects in the holy place were the table of showbread, the altar of incense, and the seven-branch candlestick. And in the cytoplasm, we have the storage of glycogen, which is bread. We have the vacuoles, which burn things up and get rid of it, like the altar of incense. And we have the mitochondria. And what happens in the mitochondria? Beta oxidation. That's where we take fuels and burn them and create energy. That's exactly what the seven-branch candlestick does. It actually takes olive oil and it burns, and that's beta oxidation. Then finally, what happens? We go into the inner chamber of the inner chamber, which is the nucleus, which is the most holy place. And in the most holy place, what do we have? We have the two tablets of stone upon which is written the code by the finger of God. And if we were to violate that code, that would lead to disease and death. And in the most holy place of the cell is the nucleus, upon which you have two strands of DNA, upon which is written by the finger of God, the code of life. And if we damage that code, we come to disease and death. So we are literally made in the sanctuary. When God created us, when God created man, he already knew the plan of salvation. He already had the sanctuary in mind. And he literally created man after the blueprint of the plan of salvation that would save man. Think about that.
Exciting.
Yeah.
One of the first foundations of our system.
Yeah. Yeah. The heavenly sanctuary, which is still there. All right, why don't we have prayer and then we'll get back upstairs. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you so much for your wisdom and for giving us a little bit of a peek into your insight of this, just a little bit. Thank you so much for giving us all of this knowledge. You've given it to us. We haven't had to wait for science to discover it, and there's still more to discover. Help us to understand its import and to apply it, more importantly, in our lives. In thy name, amen.